WSLR-LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV-LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Lou Larini with your WSLR news headlines for May 21st, 2025. Electricity may be getting more expensive. State and local organizations are urging community leaders to demand that state regulators reject an FPNL request to raise rates, which would be the largest utility rate hike in the nation, as reported by Axios. The increase from FPNL, who services about 12 million households, would amount to about $9 billion over 4 years. For the average household, that could mean an annual increases of about $200 or more, activists say, with additional hikes expected in the coming years. Organizations including Catalyst Miami, Florida Student Power, Florida Rising, and Solar United Neighbors are hosting town halls countywide to inform residents of the rate increase. No more pride lights on the Skyway or anywhere else. Despite the storm of protests last year when the state overruled local efforts to decorate bridges with rainbow lights in June for Pride Month, or in red for sickle cell awareness, or orange for gun safety, the Florida Department of Transportation, which manages state bridges, ruled it Freedom Summer and called for only red, white, and blue lights from Memorial Day to July 4th, wiping out plans for other commemorations. Expect more of the same this year. FDOT quietly passed a rule that declared lighting colors and sequences shall be a default scheme of red, white, and blue as of February 1st. The lightings would be limited to the recognition of government holidays, according to the Tampa Bay Times. The city of Sarasota received approval for its eye-catching aqua blue color scheme as a default color on the Ringling Bridge when it isn't lit up in red, white, and blue for the holidays observed by the state. Summer help is on the way from United Way Suncoast. For the first time in 20 years, United Way Suncoast is bringing its summer care program to Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties, expanding access to high-quality summer learning and child care for hundreds of families across its 5-county service areas. We wanted to be able to reach all the families to reduce those barriers, said Bonnie Cawthorn, manager of education for United Way Suncoast. Recently, United Way Suncoast and its research partner, United for Alice, released a report that showed mounting economic pressures on local working families that are barely making ends meet. Summer is a really hard time for those Alice families, Cawthorn said. This has been Lou Larini with your WSLR news headlines for May 21st, 2025.
You're listening to your own community radio station, WSLR-LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, WBPV-LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is the Peace and Justice Report, heard every Wednesday. I alternate Wednesdays with Tom Walker. Tom will be back next Wednesday on his version of the Peace and Justice Report. And what I'd like to do is mention that the opinions you hear today is strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. And I'd like to begin the show with an audio by David Swanson. Now, David Swanson is one of the leading peace activists in the country. He's the co-founder of World Beyond War. I've talked about him quite a bit. The last time he was on the show was pretty much a year ago, May. I pulled it up in my old emails. It looked like it was May 29th, 2024. And he talked about NATO. He and Medea Benjamin had written a book together all about NATO and what you should know about NATO. And this is almost like a one-year anniversary. I came across this video last night because it kind of complements the second half of the show. It's all about peace. David Swanson had written a book way back 13, 14 years ago. And the title of the book was War is a Lie. And I had him on the show then. So that was 14 years ago. And talking about all the conflicts, all the wars, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, go right down the list. And in David's opinion, virtually all of these wars could have been avoided. So this audio that I'm going to play, let me just give you a brief overview. David Swanson, he's the peace activist who co-founded World Beyond War. He argues that NATO is not a defensive alliance, but the most powerful war-making and weapons-dealing machine in history. Far from protecting democracy, NATO has backed colonial powers and dictatorships, waged illegal wars, and acted as a global promoter of militarism. In this audio, David explains that NATO operates as a lobbying arm for arms manufacturers, shifting public funds from health and education into weapons and war. Its expansions and interventions are driven largely by U.S. interests, not collective democratic decisions. With partnerships that include oppressive regimes like Israel, NATO fosters endless war, propaganda, and global insecurity. Swanson calls for its abolition, not reform, and urges global resistance through diplomacy, nonviolence, and real investment in human needs. So let me play this audio right now. And you may agree with David, you may disagree. I know a lot of people out there feel NATO is a wonderful organization, that it's without NATO, the world would be in shambles. Well, let's see what David Swanson has to say.
Mass killing operation and weapons dealership the world has ever seen. NATO is understood as an international body, almost a legal institution, something that justifies war making, that is purely defensive, that is an alliance of democracies seeking to spread democracy in the world but to defend themselves, and so forth. None of which is true. It's included colonialists and dictatorships from day one and supported them to this day. It's never fought a war that it even pretended was defensive, although it's fought numerous wars. After its first 40-some years without fighting wars, it now fights them routinely. It's primarily a weapons dealer and weapons promoter and agitator for increasing military spending and moving money from human needs and environmental needs into military spending. A lot of the expansion was funded and lobbied for and campaigned for by organizations created by weapons dealers for the purpose of being able to sell weapons to new countries in the east of Europe. And the weapons are promoted as needing to be interchangeable, and so you end up with U.S. weapons everywhere. This may be starting to change to a slight degree, and you may get Europe making more European weapons, but it's principally lining up weapons deals between countries and primarily the sale of U.S. weapons. But it also is advocating, and you can watch videos of the new current Secretary General of NATO from the Netherlands speaking to the European Union, telling them that European nations are going to need to take money out of healthcare, take money out of retirement, put it into war, take the things that the United States has done wrong and replace the successes of Europe with them. Take, you know, the success that Europe has had in funding human needs and developing a better and happier and longer and healthier lives and more sustainable environment, and get rid of all that and copy the United States. Don't come to the United States and see all the people starving and homeless on the streets, but pretend all is well and copy the United States and move your money into militarism. The United States government, the other Western governments, the corporate media outlets treat wars as legal if NATO or some other big coalition of willing nations takes part in them, as if committing a crime is not a crime if you get a whole gang to do it with you. And so NATO has gone on to wage wars. That is, NATO supports and many NATO members take part in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and so forth. It got started in Yugoslavia and Kosovo. It engaged in a massive illegal bombing. It lied about the justifications, exaggerating and fabricating crimes by the other side that were supposed to justify what it did. And it sought to establish the power to legalize its own wars. It's only invoked its Article 5, we must all fight in this war once, and that was for a U.S. war on the impoverished nation of Afghanistan halfway around the world. It's not a force of law or democracy or stability. It's the biggest organized mass killing operation and weapons dealership the world has ever seen. NATO is supposed to have members that are in Europe apart from the United States and Canada, but it has partners all over the globe. So it's, in recent decades, enlarged its membership from 12 to 32, but also added dozens of partners, which are essentially members under a different name that NATO is not obliged to join in the wars of unless it wants to, but that it can work with. And they include the most brutal dictatorships and offending war-making nations on Earth. Israel has offices and does business with NATO in NATO headquarters in Belgium. Israel is a big tester, demonstrator of weapons, seller of weapons, buyer of weapons through NATO, which again is primarily a weapons-dealing organization. And NATO has been a supporter of Israel's war making from day one. And you have U.S. threats and U.S. bribes. You have Sweden able to join if it gives more weapons to Turkey. You have nations able to join if they shut down media outlets that other members don't want operating in their country. And the U.S., you can just about predict who's going to be the next Secretary General, who's going to be a member or not, what wars are going to be engaged in or not, by what the U.S. wants. So when the U.S. wants a war in Libya, it gets a war in Libya. Some NATO members want it, some don't. It's not a collective NATO decision. There's no democracy within NATO or on NATO's agenda, but it's the U.S. Beyond being a war-making organization and a weapons-dealing organization, NATO is a propaganda-creating organization, and people should watch NATO's website and NATO's social media and the media articles and reports that are generated by NATO with very open eyes, very skeptically, and be aware of what's being pushed on them. Understand that some of us are old enough to remember, as if it were 10 minutes ago, when military spending was in dollars or dollars per capita. But now it's percentage of the economy because NATO says it should be a percentage of the economy, whether it makes any sense or not. And you need to follow what we do if you want to get to World War III. But it's defensive. This is nonsense, but it's repeated in so many videos and interviews and headlines that people start to believe it without thinking through what it is. Become media NATO skeptics. There will be a counter summit and numerous meetings and cultural events and a big demonstration march in The Hague against NATO, not to reform it or fix it or tweak it, but to shut it down, to get rid of it, to approach security through sane, nonviolent means, to support diplomacy and the rule of law and serious negotiations rather than endless militarism and armament and nuclear armament.
How to kill all mosquitoes in the...
Well, that was David Swanson. You may agree with David, you may not, but he is passionate about no more war, emphasizing the fact that... If the focus was taken off of the military-industrial complex and how we can continually supply arms to any country that wants them, if we looked at the fact that we're spending trillions of dollars that could be used for every other need in this country, whether it's health care, whether it's feeding the homeless, finding a house for the homeless, anything and everything, it would be a totally different country and a totally different world. But that's not what is happening as I speak to you this morning. So I thought I'd look for a piece from David Swanson because it's related in many ways to the next person I'm going to talk to you about. I initially came in contact with David Swanson back around 2011 when he had written the book No More War, and we were fortunate enough to have him on the air and for him to talk about that book. And then a year ago, I had him on the air, and he talked about the book he had written with Medea Benjamin, NATO, What You Need to Know. We've had so many peace activists on the Peace and Justice Report over the years, activists who have been fighting their whole adult life to change the narrative from how do we find peace out of and get away from what's been going on. And people have been living their whole lives with war. If you were born back during Vietnam, it just stretched right continuously to the interventions in Central America with El Salvador, and we can talk about Colombia and Latin and South America. We can talk about the Philippines, and of course then we came to Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we have Russia, Ukraine, and Israel, and what's going on in Gaza. But it's never how do we obtain peace before these wars begin. But that's what David Swanson's all about. So the second guest, who I do not have in the studio, but I recorded an interview with him the other day. He's now based in California. And I initially met him back in 2011. He was in Sarasota giving a talk. And he is the co-founder of Food Not Bombs. And Food Not Bombs came into being 45 years ago this week. And they're celebrating their 45th anniversary. And that's how and why I decided to have him as a guest, a recorded guest. And his name is Keith McHenry. And as I said, I had recorded the interview with Keith, but as a prelude to the Keith McHenry interview, I was thinking of someone who preached peace, love, understanding, no more war, war is a lie, and I certainly thought of David Swanson. So I figured I'd combine the David Swanson audio with the Keith McHenry audio, which, as I said, I spoke to him last Wednesday and recorded this, and I thought it would be appropriate because, as I said, Food Not Bombs is celebrating their 45th anniversary. Let me read you a little bit about Food Not Bombs. Food Not Bombs is a loose-knit group of independent collectives sharing free, usually vegan and vegetarian food with others. The group believes that corporate and government priorities are skewed to allow hunger to persist in the midst of abundance. To demonstrate this, Food Not Bombs serves surplus food gathered from grocery stores, bakeries, and markets, which would otherwise go to waste, or occasionally has already been thrown away. Food Not Bombs. Food Not Bombs is an all-volunteer global movement sharing free, usually vegan meals, as I mentioned. And according to the Food Not Bombs website, the group's central beliefs are meals are free to anyone. Each chapter is independent and autonomous and makes decisions via consensus. They're dedicated to nonviolence. Their views food as a right, not a privilege. And coinciding with these benefits, the beliefs, the group goals are to combat poverty and homelessness, to facilitate community gatherings of hungry people, to allow anyone to volunteer to help, cook, and then eat. So it came into being in Cambridge, Massachusetts, by anti-nuclear activists, and Keith McHenry was one of the co-founders. And according to Keith, the name came about when he discovered that they were distributing food to poor just across the street from a new building development for Draper Laboratories, where rumor had it they were designing nuclear weapons. McHenry says that it made the group realize that there are hungry people on one side of the street, and there are people on the other that are making money making nuclear weapons. And Keith was initially based in Cambridge, Boston area. He moved to New Mexico. He was based in Taos, New Mexico for many years. And the last 8 or 9 years, he's been in Santa Cruz, California. And before I put his interview on, I should mention that there are Food Not Bombs is located all over the world. There are Food Not Bombs since its inception. It's become a global organization in Africa, Asia, Europe, the Middle East, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, with over 500 chapters. And there are 32 known Food Not Bombs group in Canada, as well as in London, England, Prague, Melbourne, Australia, and even in Ukraine. Offshoots of the organization were present in the West Bank and Palestine. And the organization works with Earth First, the Antarctic Black Cross, the IWW, Homes Not Jails, Anti-Racist Action, Farm Animal Rights Movement, In Defense of Animals, the Free Radio Movement, and many other organizations. So when I had talked to Keith on the phone the other day, I had began the recording when he was talking about how he had traveled all around the world and had met people who were working with Food Not Bombs in many, many different countries. So I'm going to see if I can get this to come up right now, and we'll see how it comes. Oh, for some reason, I could not open that. Don't ask me why. I'm going to have to figure out how I can get that to play. But in the meantime, I have something else I would like to play, and it is related to somebody else who has been fighting for peace his whole life, and that's Mumia Abu-Jamal. So what I'm going to do is see if I can pull Mumia up while I try to access that Keith McHenry interview. And in the meantime, we will get back to a little bit of Bob Marley. But Bob has taken a minute to come back on, so we will... to the Peace and Justice Report. My name is Bob Connors. Tom Walker will be on next Wednesday with his version of the Peace and Justice Report. And as I said, I was looking for Mamie Abu-Jamal. I have him now, and this is a commentary, Ball of Confusion, the Oncoming Depression. When we think about the economy, most of us are in a ball of confusion. A ball of confusion isn't just a great song back during the days of R&B. And let me continue with his commentary. This is my Mumia Abu-Jamal. Let me make sure. I just want to make sure one thing here before I put on Mumia. I want to make sure that Bob Marley has left the scene, which I believe he has, but I will find out. Let's see if Bob is still on.
There will be no
Bob is still on, so I'm going to see
have
if I
pity
can.
Pity on those whose chances grow stand. There ain't no hiding place from the Father of creation.
Found Bob Marley. He said he had enough for now. He'll join you later. Here's Mumia Abu-Jamal, Ball of Confusion.
Think about the economy. We're in a ball of confusion. A ball of confusion isn't just a great song back during the days of R&B rhythm and blues. A ball of confusion, that things are happening all around us that continues to confuse us, and therefore
They destabilize us. Because when you're confused, you can't move. You are psychologically a deer caught in headlights. Let's think about the economy right now. We're entering the age of tariffs, which is almost unprecedented in American modern history. We have just heard a spokesman for the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. These are cats who are the masters of capitalist accumulation, or in other words, getting and keeping money. And they said that the downfall in economic activity in the United States is approaching rates equitable to 1932. When I heard those words, a chill went through my bones. Because 1932 is the era of the Great Depression. You'll hear on every channel, with the possible exception of Fox or Newsmax, an economist say that we are approaching a recession. A recession only means two quarters of downward activity in economic. That means several months, 6 months or more. But no one dares use the D word. And I ain't talking about democracy. The D word is depression. It is one of the most feared words in the English language. But the IMF just went there. They didn't just come up with a number and say 1932. They were speaking in economic language to economists and historians and analysts that this economy is approaching a depression. And that should concern everybody in this country. It is true that the vast majority of economic activity in America is customer generated. That means that when people go out and buy, they are the engines of the American economy. And that's why the American economy is so robust. But if that's true, the obverse is true as well. When there is a lack of that kind of economic activity, then recessions, and yes, depression, is in the future. It is nothing to celebrate, but it is something to think about and consider very seriously. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Of course, that was Mumia Abu-Jamal. If you know anything about the history of Mumia Abu-Jamal, he's been in prison now for about 40 years. For a crime most people feel he did not commit. He hasn't got a, according to the people who have been looking at his case, there's a documentary out there that goes through pretty much all the facts surrounding the case. They've been looking for a retrial for all these many years, and there has never been a retrial. So I'm going to pull someone up who's... What I'm going to do is play one more audio by Mumia, and it's the title of this audio is The Road to Madness, and we'll see how this one goes. The Road to Madness, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
the road to madness. I think once people have a second thought, they'll realize the gravity and the scope of their mass stupidity. And I hate to put it that way, but sometimes it is what it is. You know, if you elect a fool, you cannot be surprised when you see foolishness. And that's what it is. And this cat is breaking everything in the house. And it's wonderful and terrifying at the same time. Because, you know, we must recognize that for the most powerful empire, perhaps in world history, to believe that it has been cheated by the rest of the world instead of the reverse is an example of mass media manipulated delusion. Terrifying, because the pain and suffering that will come from this is probably close to incalculable. It will be in the trillions of dollars. It's as if you took trillions of dollars and burnt it, and just burnt it. That's what's happening. And that's why the business class, the corporate class, are head on fire about this. And they're trying to get through to a blockhead who cannot hear them because his ego is so loud. And so it's terrible, because we're seeing history being made every day, and not in a good way. This is why it's wonderful. Lenin once said, there are years and decades when nothing happens. And there are days when decades happen, when things happen. We're in the middle of a kind of social transformation that we cannot see the end of, because of stupidity, because of political ego, and because really of a profound kind of recklessness, right? Like in the last week, $6 trillion just disappeared. Just disappeared. And I am informed when I look at the news and I hear about the bond markets, and for the first time in decades, the bond markets, speaking of, you know, treasury bills, so-called T-bills, which may have a 10-year yield, a 30-year yield, or a 50-year yield, for the first time, the number of bonds sold declined in this period. That's remarkable, because when the economy is in chaos, which it is, the last place people invest in are T-bills, because this is considered a safe security backed by the government. But when that number started to decline, people were looking at the government and saying, I can't trust these people. I am not investing in T-bills. So that suggests that they were long-term investors, or even international investors, who shifted their currency somewhere else or just declined to buy. That was the danger sign that made Trump go with this 90-day pause. And he heard from some people at the top of the financial heap that moved him. But I think it's too little, too late. In many ways, the damage is done. Because it's of a piece. It's not like one thing. It's of a piece of what's happening politically, economically, in terms of immigrants, the executive orders, they're bordering on madness, the DEI, all this stuff. It's mindless bullshit, but it's mean. And it has its impact. And people are looking at the United States in ways they have never looked at it in our lifetimes. Perhaps Vietnam was close. But this is another kind of internal madness that is burning at the heart of the empire.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel.
Another powerful commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal from Prison Radio. There are many prisoners who give commentaries on Prison Radio. I'm going to look to line up Noel Hanrahan, who founded Prison Radio, I believe it was about 30 years ago. And thanks to Noel, the prisoners have a voice. The website is prisonradio.org. There are other prisoners besides Mumia who have commentaries, many of them talking about the conditions that they have to suffer through in prison. Many of them talking about the inequities even in the prison system. Or maybe it might be about the food they eat, or it might be about the way the prisoners are treated in general. But go to prisonradio.org, and there were many, many, many prisoners who now have a voice thanks to Prison Radio, and thanks to Noel Hanrahan, who I am going to line up so she can explain to us all about Prison Radio, how she happened to become a founder of Prison Radio, and how she stays in contact. She goes and visits Mumia Abu-Jamal on a monthly basis. So that's one of the highlights in her life, is being able to give someone like Mumia the opportunity to have his commentaries heard. Of course, Mumia has written about 13 books, I believe, and you can pull up Mumia Abu-Jamal on Prison Radio or other places, and it incredibly powerful. And I wasn't able to pull that recording up for one reason or another. I'm not sure why, with Keith McHenry, the co-founder of Food Not Bombs. But I have come across something that I think will be of interest to you. Actually, the person I'm going to play it's from the Speaking Truth to Youth series by Robert Shetterly and Americans Who Tell the Truth. I've had Rob Shetterly on the show many times over the last 11, 12 years. He is responsible for all the portraits of all those Americans, over 275 Americans Who Tell the Truth, ranging from Abraham Lincoln to Howard Zinn to Bruce Gagnon, who was on the show 2 weeks ago. And I've played a Speaking to Youth audio before, but this is David Rovics, and he is I guess he refers to himself simply as a songwriter or a musician, but perhaps can be more fully described as an American acoustic protest singer. Unlike most recording artists, Rovics makes all of his music available online for free and encourages fans to videotape his concerts. When he performs live, he doesn't use a set list, but lets the concert unfold on its own. He actually played at Fogartyville probably, it was about 12 years ago, I believe it was, and he released his first all-original album back in 1998. He followed it with several more, including the all-MP3 released Who Would Jesus Bomb? He cut 21 albums between 1996 and 2011. Rovick's lyrics offer listeners plenty to think about. He encourages the have-nots of the world to stick together in Union Makes Us Strong. During the Depression, people fought and won back then. Now the battle's global, and it must be won again. In Berkshire Hills, he takes a step back and in time to Shay's Rebellion. He said to hell with King John Adams, of his foss we'd had our fill, and we set our sights on liberty here in the Berkshire Hills. As a secular Jew, Rovick takes Israel to task in Lebanon, 2006. 100,000 homes leveled to the ground, every olive branch on offer burned where it was found, every chance at dialogue rejected right on cue. If you're going to burn your bridges, you might as well bomb them too. Rovick believes music can connect people in ways nothing else can. We're using music at marches and rallies to inspire the troops and to educate people about things that are happening, and to talk about it in a way that hopefully might be more memorable than a speech. There's something about music that makes people feel optimistic, he says. To anyone who'd like to do what he does, he says, keep writing, keep learning, be open to criticism from yourself or others on music or politics. Never delude yourself into thinking you're original. Keep listening to music and learning songs others people wrote. Keep your heart open. See the world. Put yourself in other people's shoes regularly. David lives in Portland, Oregon with his wife and daughter. He writes for Counterpunch and Truth Out. He travels around the world, many trips to Europe. And I'd like to play the Speaking to Youth audio and video that is on. Let me see. I just had it right here. And here it is. David Rovick, Speaking Youth, Speaking Truth to Youth.
Thank you for being with me today for our Speaking Truth to Youth project, and I just have a few questions I want to ask you. The first one is...
Life runs on its own schedule.
Okay, I'm going to pull this up. No question it's going to come on. Let's see. Hold on 1 second.
David, thank you so much for being with me today for our Speaking Truth to Youth project. And I just have a few questions I want to ask you. The first one is, what in your youth led you to become an activist?
The first thing that happened that kind of got me thinking that things are not as they should be was the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown in Pennsylvania when I was, I think, 10. And then I had the good luck to sort of get plugged into the anti-nuclear movement in Massachusetts because of going to a camp in Western Massachusetts run by a Unitarian minister named Doug Wilson and the Roe camp. And that's what got me started. Started with the anti-nuke thing, and then it quickly spread, you know, as you know, you find out one thing that's wrong, and then you start realizing that it's all connected with all kinds of other problems.
So as a young person, a 10-year-old, did you feel guided at all by family or community or school?
The main thing for me as far as feeling guided was the Roe camp and conference center and the anti-nuclear movement that I sort of discovered and plugged into a little. Otherwise, school and my home environment in Wilton, Connecticut was profoundly alienating. I didn't know anybody else around there who was against nuclear power. I was the only one I knew. And then my family was involved with that because that's how I discovered Roe Camp, was through my mother. So it certainly was, you know, also family related. I grew up in a wealthy suburb of New York City, and I think it's not at all representative of how it is for you know, so many other people in the country. But I think also the public school atmosphere in the U.S. tends not to be encouraging of political dissent. I mean, it's certainly not my experience with it, but I haven't visited all that many public schools other than the one I went to. I have done some performing in high schools, maybe about 20 times in my entire career. And every time I have performed in a school, that whoever brought me there has gotten in trouble. I think in the United States, that is, not in other countries, but in the United States, without exception, even people that did not think they were going to get in trouble. But then, you know, I end up singing about something that offends somebody and, you know, and then, yeah, they get in trouble.
What continues to guide you or give you courage and motivate you all these years?
For one thing, there's no future without hope. So hope is a necessary prerequisite for anything else happening. So, you know, as a performer, as a musician, I have always thought of myself as sort of a cheerleader for the movement, whatever movement that might be happening. And as, you know, in that position, I try to, you know, apply my musical skills to keep the movement going and keep people feeling a sense of community and feeling inspired, trying to do that thing that music can do so well in a movement that involves music. So what always gives me any kind of motivation is the fact that anybody is having music at their protests and asking me to sing at them. And lately, I find my motivation outside of the United States, where I'm speaking to you from now.
Why do you think people outside of the United States are more likely to include music in their protests or their activism?
I was just in Mexico last month talking with a former guerrilla fighter for the FMLN from El Salvador, and I was telling him, we don't have music at our protests in the U.S. anymore. And he was shocked. And he said, how can that be? Music is the beating heart of the resistance. I think it's a really important question for people to try to figure out. You know, all I know for sure is that the history of social movements all over the world has always involved music. In the U.S., which is home to so much music that has become so popular all over the world, so many different styles of music, from hip hop to jazz to bluegrass to you name it, so much rock and roll, so much stuff that has just taken the world by storm. For us not to have music at our rallies is a shocking development of the past 10, 12 years. And, you know, I try to get my head around why it's happened. But it's what's very clear. It's very bad, and people need to get their hearts back connected to their heads and realize that, you can't have a social movement that sustains itself and that grows, that has any sense of community around it, if music isn't central to it. That's just how humans are. I mean, one thing that I think, we can't necessarily, understate is we don't know what the FBI has been up to for the past 50 years or so. We do know what they were doing from the time they came into existence up until 1971. During that period, from 1908 to 1971, we have a very good public record of what the FBI has been doing. And during that time, their main reason for existing was to distract, demoralize, and spread disinformation within the left. That was their job from 1908 until 1971. First, they undermined and ultimately destroyed the industrial workers of the world. Then they moved on to the Communist Party in the 1930s. Then they moved on to the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, the Anti-War Movement, and SDS, and American Indian Movement. And they did their best to undermine and destroy all those organizations. And that's all a matter of the public record, because the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI raided the FBI offices in Media, Pennsylvania in 1971 and liberated 1,000 secret documents that told the world about the counterintelligence program that they had been involved with. And one of their main activities was making sure that the cultural wing and the political wing of this amorphous phenomenon that was the 60s Renaissance, you know, making sure that these elements of the movement did not connect, or that when they did connect, making sure that they got disconnected, because they saw how powerful the confluence of these things were, how millions of people, their hearts and minds were demilitarized by this phenomenon of all these free festivals that actually make love not war. It was working on millions and millions of people. They did make love not war. They dropped out of the military. They refused to obey commands. They wouldn't obey draft orders. They left the United States. They went to other countries. It all worked. Yeah, the war kept going, but this movement was tremendously impactful as far as keeping music out of the movement. They've done a great job of convincing us that we don't want music. And how we've become convinced of that is a multifaceted, full spectrum kind of process. Like, there's so many different points at which you might think, oh, we should have music in this event. And then there's so many different reasons why you might decide, oh, maybe we shouldn't. If the decision is, let's not have music at the event, you are asking the wrong question. You know, if you're choosing between one performer or another, that's good. You know, that you should do that as an organizer. But if your choice is, let's not have music at this event for some reason, that wasn't a good decision. There's a lot of others, you know, fear of people not being on message, fear of not having a musician that is writing about the issue that you're holding a protest about, or you can't find musicians who want to play for free that will only play for 10 minutes. They want longer, or can't find enough musicians who are not white to fulfill your diversity, your desires for diversity. So work on diversifying the program later, but don't reject the white musicians because they're white. I mean, this is identity politics gone wild. You know, I blame social media a lot in terms of you know, inculcating people with all kinds of false consciousness around identity politics. So many people are so chronically online, not just young people, but all kinds of people.
What advice do you have for young people, not just about social media, but in general?
For everyone, my advice is really that that we need to gather in physical spaces and turn off the screens, turn off social media. If you use social media, use it as a bullhorn. Announce what's going on, you know, put something out that you might, you know, that's good, that you hope might spread. Don't engage in debates in comment threads on any of those platforms. Half the people you're talking to are bots. I hope that most young people especially are now, by now, aware that half of the people you're talking to on those platforms are not actually people. Close all that up and go outside and be part of a society, your town, in physical location. Promote events with posters, physical media, you know, put up stickers, you know, talk to people, make phone calls. I'm not rejecting technology by any means. I'm talking about these massive corporations that are controlling our means of communications. I'm rejecting them, these billionaires, not you know, artificial intelligence or, you know, any of these other cool things, you know, that we could parse these things out. You know, technology isn't a bad thing per se. You can't organize a revolution on Instagram. It's not going to work. They're going to make sure it doesn't work. You know, we have other means of communication and we need to get back to those. But that's a message for everybody, specifically for the youth. For far longer than I've been alive and for longer than any youth has been alive, there has been a corporate cult of youth that has been pushing itself on our consciousness. It predates the 60s, but it was big in the 60s, and it's been big ever since then. They're trying to tell us that people who are older are ignorant and they have no wisdom to pass on, and they're just a bunch of whatever, and that the youth are brilliant and the youth are going to lead the future and the youth have all the answers, and they're lying. None of it's true. Young people don't know so much because they're young. You have to live and see the world to learn stuff. Don't let anybody tell you that you're brilliant and you have all the answers when you're 20. You don't. They don't want you to listen to older people who actually know something. And the rest of the world understands that. It's in the United States that we've been fed this cult of youth thing and we've swallowed it. And so they also have in England and other places, but it's a particular problem in the United States. You leave the U.S. and you see people admire older people. They're interested in their experiences with the resistance, with revolutions, with civil wars, with social movements, all of the sorts of things that people who have lived long enough might have lived long enough to experience in the United States and all over the world. Older people are the people who have actually been around long enough to have figured some things out. That's why they don't want you listening to them.
Well, there's about a minute left on that interview with David Robichs, but we're running out of time. You must go to David Robichs' website.